Well, I guess congratulations are in order. We've made it to the bottom of hell, to the ninth circle, to the last place of punishment in Dante's Inferno. As we mentioned at the end of the last lecture, this is the place where fraud is punished also, but a special kind of fraud, what has been named complex fraud, because it involves not simply the sin itself, but also the sin as directed against those who have a kind of special claim on us, those to whom we owe a special trust, family, or country, or guests, or Lord. And what we see when we get to the very end, the ultimate examples of fraud, they are found in the mouth of Satan himself, with Judas, the betrayer of Christ, occupying the sort of prominent central place in the central of the three heads of Satan, and the betrayers Brutus and Cassius and the other two mouths. What we're going to do, I guess, is try and get there, but get there by way of talking about one of the most interesting stories in the entire Commedia, another one of the pairs that Dante brings together for us. We're going to talk a little bit about the story of two guys named Ugolino and Ruggieri.
Very often, when today we talk about hell lightly, we think of it being a place that's hot with lots of fire, hotter than the hinges of hell, we will say, about a summer's day. But in fact, if you think about it, Dante has used fire rather infrequently in his punishments. And when we get to the bottom of hell, there's no fire at all. In fact, it is ice. It's the coldest place there is. And we want to think about that. When Dante uses fire, he probably has some special reasons for doing it. After all, we can associate the fire of the love of God and fire as the tongues of fire at Pentecost, and therefore the gift of the Holy Spirit. But down here, it's cold, and the sinners are frozen at different depths into ice. In fact, some of the last sinners he meets are actually totally frozen inside the ice, and therefore he can't communicate with them. So as we get down to the bottom of hell, it's not hotter than the hinges of hell. It's colder than we can possibly imagine.
And the sinners themselves, encased in this ice, are therefore characterized by a kind of immobility. And for the first time, we see Dante sort of actively sort of taking part in the punishment of these sinners by not giving them what they want and sort of treating them rather badly. Again, another one of the signs throughout Inferno that Dante is beginning to learn something. But what's interesting in this particular case with Ugolino and Ruggieri is that once again, we have another example of a pair of sinners locked together. Remember, we started with Paolo and Francesca, who were in one kind of embrace as they're being whirled around in the tempest of lust. We saw, as a pair, Farinata and Cavalcante. They both spoke, but not at the same time, and as we said pretty emphatically, without recognizing each other's existence. We saw Ulysses and Diomede, and Ulysses is the only one who does any talking. Well, that pattern is continued here. Again, another interesting kind of embrace, if you want to put it that way, because Ugolino is seen munching on the head of Ruggieri. Sort of the last example of sinners reminds us of the first by a kind of interesting and sort of frightening comparison contrast thing. But Ugolino is the only one who does any talking to us. Now, this is a very important thing for us to think about because Ugolino spends a lot of time telling us what an awful and terrible and really inhuman set of actions was performed against him and his family by Ruggieri. But in the process, what he totally fails to do is to point out this little minor detail that he was doing just as much to Ruggieri and that he's every bit as much implicated in this horrendous sort of cross-current of betrayal and counter-betrayal that the counter is all about. So before we look at the text, we might want to say just a little bit about who these two guys were.
We're now turning to the city of Pisa, and we're turning to another round of the Guelph Ghibelline controversy. In fact, Dante is very careful in the very bottom of hell every place we go down here at the bottom, we got Guelphs and Ghibellines together. Now, remember, Dante's a Guelph, and sometimes we read in popular Dante criticism that what Dante really wanted to do in writing Inferno was to stick all the guys he didn't like down there. And this is not it at all. That's really to miss the point. The point would be here especially that Dante has to come to understand, dealing with Farinata and Cavalcante, for example, that factionalism in and of itself is a bad thing, a destroyer of community, a destroyer of basic bonds. And Guelphs and Ghibellines are both part of the problem. It's not one is a problem and the other is a solution. So here's the basic problem that's going on in Pisa about a decade before the Commedia is set. Pisa is a Ghibelline stronghold surrounded by Guelph neighbors, such as Florence, for example. And because of that, various Guelph neighbors are attacking Pisa and taking castles sort of out in the boonies of Pisan territory. So the Archbishop of Pisa, a guy named Ruggieri, who is a Ghibelline, says, got a clever idea. Why don't we hire a Guelph as our sort of temporary city manager? The Italian term is Podestà. That way, he can negotiate with his Guelph buddies and get us a better deal than we can get for ourselves. And so they hire Ugolino to be the Podestà of Pisa. And as soon as Ugolino arrives, we start mutual betrayal. Ruggieri immediately realizes this was a bad idea. He's no longer in power himself, and therefore works to undercut Ugolino's authority. On the other hand, Ugolino says to his Guelph buddies, go ahead and take that castle out there. That's okay. I'm not going to come get you. We're Guelph buddies after all. So he's betraying his office in Pisa, just as Ruggieri is betraying Pisa as well by trying to undercut Ugolino's authority from the beginning. So we've got this scene of mutual betrayal. And Dante takes this well-known story as a way of addressing this question. If you have hatred, factionalism, selfishness, nothing else matters but me, how far can it go? How bad can it get, both on earth and as it's reflected in the afterlife?
To what Bill said, I would like to sort of piggyback one footnote, and that is that in addition to the horrible problem of factionalism and where it ultimately leads, this also deals with another issue that's been coming up pretty consistently in our discussion, and that is the interference, the wrong relationship between sacred and secular, because, of course, Ugolino is a government official and Ruggieri is a church cardinal. And so the two things that Dante seems to be saying are most responsible for the messed up situation of the world in his own time, the factionalism and that distorted relationship between spiritual and secular, both come together here in the story that's told. Remember, it's told only from the point of view of one person, from Ugolino, and he brings it up as though he is, and again, I hate to sort of sound this corny, but it really does work, as though he is a kind of after-dinner speaker, because there he is munching on the head of his archenemy, Ruggieri, and as it says at the very beginning of Canto 33, lifting his mouth from his horrendous meal, the sinner first wiped off his messy lips in the hair remaining on the chewed-up skull, then spoke, "You want me to renew a grief so desperate that just the thought of it, much less the telling, grips my heart with pain. But if my words can be a seed to bear the fruit of infamy for this betrayer who feeds my hunger, then I shall speak in tears." If you remember back to the beginning with Francesca, Francesca says, speaking, telling my story, it hurts, but I'll do it anyhow because you've asked. And in that, we saw the essence of Francesca's sin. She's just a girl who can't say no, right? Here, he's saying it hurts. Again, that deliberate sort of recognition of what happened at the beginning, that imitation of it. It hurts, but I'm going to talk anyhow. Why? I don't care what happens to me as long as I can get him. I will endure anything in order to get my enemy. In a nutshell, that's the essence of sin for Dante, that recognition that sin ultimately hurts you first, foremost, and above all, but that ain't going to stop you. And so you see in his desire to tell the story the nature of the sin reenacted.
Another way to say this is to look at what's actually happening down here in hell, frozen in the ice, up to their necks, Ugolino munching on the head of Ruggieri. Ron sometimes asks this to our students, which one would you rather be? That is to say, which one really is the worst situation, to be eaten by another person or to be eating another human being? And it's easy for us, again, because we only have Ugolino's point of view here, to see that Ugolino is in the better situation. But we really ought to ask that question seriously. And I think what we're struck with is the utter horror of both of their positions. Not that Ugolino's a little bit better off. In fact, they're in exactly the same situation, even though one is, to use Ron's word, one is the muncher and one is the munchie.
Well, he tells his story, again, leaving out all of the parts that implicate himself in the treachery, and tells it in such a way that it is meant to evoke the greatest possible amount of sort of pity and terror on the part of the listener. And one of the reasons why it probably should provide us with that kind of a reaction is because it wasn't just about Ugolino and Ruggieri going after each other. It's about the innocent people who got in the way and suffered because of it. And in this case, it turns out to be Ugolino's children. Once Ugolino is arrested, so to speak, and put in this tower, his children are put in there with him. And so what Ugolino decides to do is sort of focus his story on the suffering of his children. Now, as a kind of strategy to get our pity, it works. As a strategy to sort of see what a bad guy Ruggieri is, it works. But, of course, it also works to put the blame on Ugolino himself, who is equally responsible for the whole situation. And it also works to make a point that Dante is clearly interested in making, namely, the problem with all this evil stuff is that lots of innocent people get dragged down with it. And the image for that, again, going back to biblical times, of course, is what happens to innocent children, all right? That the suffering of innocent children as a kind of image for the consequences of radical evil continues from then to Dante and all the way beyond until now.
When we met up with Francesca and Paolo in Inferno 5, one of the things we said is we really have to dissect her story very carefully, because if we don't, if we simply take her at her word, we're going to misunderstand radically what's going on. Maybe that seemed like a kind of leisurely activity when we were dealing with Francesca. It's absolutely dead serious down here. That is to say, if we take Ugolino in his own terms, as he expects us to understand him, we're going to miss an extraordinarily powerful lesson about the nature of sin, about the nature of evil, that hopefully we have developed the skills as readers, starting with that Francesca encounter, so that we can see that these speakers are telling us more than they think they are about themselves if we are discerning readers. Dante had problems at the beginning, if you recall, in misinterpreting Francesca, and we no doubt felt sympathy for that. Now we're down here in the bottom of hell, and Dante understands what's going on, and so must we. So we hope we've honed our skills as we've journeyed with the pilgrim and hear this story, because as the story begins to unfold, they're not only in prison, but one day Ugolino realizes they're nailing the door closed. They're nailing the door through which they were fed closed. And Ugolino almost immediately understands what that means. And therefore, the dramatic story that he unfolds is what happens after the nailing up of the door of the tower in Pisa.
And of course, what happens is that he realizes, to a degree that his children don't, that they're being slowly starved to death. Again, a kind of consequence of radical betrayal. And he tells it in terms of the slow but inevitable movement towards starvation, the helplessness that he feels as a parent when all of a sudden they're hungry, asking for food, there's nothing that he can do, and also just sort of death by death, he recounts what happens to his children. It was around noon, the time they usually brought us our food, but now each one of us was full of dread from dreaming. Then from below, I heard them driving nails into the dreadful tower's door. With that, I stared in silence at my flesh and blood. I did not weep. I turned to stone inside. They wept, and my little Anselmuccio spoke, "What is it, Father? Why do you look that way?" For them I held my tears back, saying nothing. All of that day and then all of that night until another sun shone on the world. A meager ray of sunlight found its way to the misery of our cell, and I could see myself reflected four times in their faces. Well, it continues, they offer, the children do, to feed their father with their own flesh. He refuses that. They die one by one. And then he picks it up with the account of his own death. Just as you see me here, I saw the other three fall one by one as the fifth day and the sixth day passed, and I, by then gone blind, groped over their dead bodies. Though they were dead, 2 days I called their name. Then hunger proved more powerful than grief. Well, what is it that Ugolino is saying there?
Although scholars have disputed that question for centuries, it seems to us that what Ugolino says is, I ate them. That he simply had hunger being more powerful than grief, and therefore to sustain his life just a little bit longer. After all, he ate his own children. There's this image of cannibalism back on Earth in Pisa, and of course it's reflected in the cannibalism down in hell of Ugolino munching on the head of Ruggieri. One of the things that always strikes me is, as Ugolino moves into sort of the final phase of telling this story, he says to Dante, aren't you weeping? If you don't weep at my story, do you ever weep? And yet, just a few lines later, he says, and when I was confronted with this and my children, I did not weep. Ron read the line. I had turned to stone inside. What an odd notion that this is a story that should invoke weeping from anyone. It didn't invoke weeping from him. Now, one could sort of read this as sort of the Stoic father, but I don't think that's it. He's turned to stone inside. That the kind of life he's led, the kind of betrayal that he's carried out, the kind of real sort of, you know, leave every human consideration out in the wheeling and dealing of castles and politics and all this sort of stuff, he's become stone. And at a time when his children need him, and this emotional bond should be as tight as it can possibly be, he tells us he's made of stone.
And it's interesting in particular because that idea of having a heart of stone is something that is presented very specifically in the prophet Ezekiel. If we look at the other prophets, remember we told you in earlier lectures how important they are to Dante's sensibility. One of the things that's very interesting is to see how often they refer to images of cannibalism when it becomes time to talk about what happens when there's nothing left whatsoever of the covenant. That the absolute betrayal of the covenant leads to or is imaged by cannibalism. So there's a kind of connection between what's happening here on earth, what's happening here in hell, and what's happening here with the prophets, all sort of brought together in a very powerful way. And again, if you begin thinking about this, we can also bring in addition to the biblical authors, we can also bring in classical authors as well. One of the things that's kind of interesting, if you think about cannibalism as an image, is the way in which it is, with father eating children in particular, it is sort of the absolute denial of the idea of pietas, the idea of loyalty, that we've already talked about as being so important in defining who Aeneas is, that Aeneas is who he is because of the set of relationships that he has to father and son. Ulysses is who he is by the denial of that set of relationships. Here you have the kind of ultimate denial of that set of relationships with a father munching on the head of, or munching on his children, and then going back to picking it up by munching on his enemy here in hell. In other words, what's so nifty about the dramatic power of this line is that when he tells that final line in his story, right, the story is over, but he immediately goes back to the meal that he's having, the eternal meal, munching on the head of his arch enemy, the archbishop. Well, that becomes a kind of nifty way to suggest that maybe, to follow up with what Bill said a few minutes ago, maybe being the munchee is no worse than being the muncher. That is to say, by going back to that meal on Ruggieri's head, he is eternally reenacting his final act on earth, the one that is the total denial and betrayal of any kind of love whatsoever. And so in a way, it's kind of as though two things are happening at the same time. Doing this, he's punishing himself in this extraordinary way. He's also getting exactly what he wanted. Okay, that one of the things that this canto seems to me to be all about is that if you think about what you would love to do to your worst enemy, beyond anything else you could ever think of, gosh, I'd like to be able to munch on his head. He gets it. He gets to do exactly what he wants. And in Dante's vision of hell, the punishment is really to get what you want when nothing stands in the way of your desires. And if nothing stands in the way of your desires, what you have is a kind of cannibalism as an image for ultimate and final evil.
One way to contextualize this politically, something Ron alluded to earlier, is to say, if you took sort of the partisan politics of Farinata and Cavalcante, and again said, how far can that go? Remember, they simply ignore each other, even though they're neighbors for eternity in the same tomb. How far could you go? How far could you push that? Where will ultimately the attitudes that we see in other sinners and in the world of partisan politics, where will it lead? How far can it go when all of a sudden me, power, control are all that matter and the most fundamental bonds are broken? Bonds with my neighbor, bonds with my government, bonds with my family, bonds with God. Everything is sacrificed here to this desire that, as Ron said, is totally uncontrolled. It's also a matter of saying something like this. What if you look at a world and you see nothing simply but politics and physical objects and whatever? That's the totality of reality. There's no spirit, not just in a sort of technical theological term, but there's nothing except stuff. And, you know, collecting power and collecting things. Well, it's interesting because that's an image that develops in chapter 6 of John's Gospel, where Jesus is saying, I am the bread of life and you must eat my body and drink my blood. Obviously not talking literally, but in spirit. But some of the people around respond, ooh, this is more than we can stomach. In other words, if you listen to those words literally, they're cannibalism. If you fill those words full of spirit, they're this intimate union with your Lord. What happens when that whole spiritual dimension is eradicated?
And of course, what that means is that Dante is bringing in the resonances that would have been available to him as a Christian, that in Dante's Christian world, the way that you show love is through a banquet, the Eucharist, in which you are eating the body and blood of Christ. Well, it shows, of course, as Bill says, the necessity of spiritual understanding in that meal, but it also shows the kind of nifty inversion that's going on here. As Bill put it, what you have is the letter without the spirit of that banquet, and the letter without the spirit turns out to be cannibalism.
It's also interesting that the final sinners Dante meets before he gets to Satan himself, later on in Inferno 33, describe back on earth a banquet. They invited their family for dinner. They had a code word. And when it was time for dessert, the servants came in and slaughtered the members of the family. So we go from this banquet of Ugolino and Ruggieri to another one. And then when Dante finally does come face to face with Satan, there's still another banquet because, as Ron pointed out at the beginning of this lecture, Satan has three heads, and in each one is a sinner being chewed.
And, of course, that's the vision that Dante sees in Canto 34, the last canto of the Inferno. He gets to have a meeting, if that's the right word, face to face with Satan. Now, again, it's kind of interesting to see in terms of what has already come along, the way that this meeting is sort of put together. Makes sense that there wouldn't be any real direct encounter, any dialogue between Dante and Satan. And in fact, there's nothing intelligible coming from Satan at all. Dante looks and is sort of stupefied by what he sees, and it seems to be the sort of unstated sort of very real sense that we better get out of here pretty quickly before we sort of take part in this nuclear meltdown worth of evil. But what you do get to see is a kind of interesting way of summing up what the entire infernal experience has been. That, in a sense, what we can do is look at the image of Satan as a kind of image that puts its seal on everything that we've seen, starting when we went through the gates of hell and going all the way down to the very end.
One way to do it is to remember that in the mythology that Dante is using, Satan led a rebellion in which he got some other angels to participate against God himself in heaven, and God sort of flung him down and he stuck in the middle of the earth. Well, remember, some of the first folks, some of the first things we met in Inferno 3 when we went through the gates of hell were those angels who remained neutral during the rebellion, that wouldn't take any side at all. Here's the leader of the rebellion much further down. So that's one connection between the beginning of our entrance into hell and the end here in Inferno 34.
There are a whole bunch of other ways to take a look at Satan. One of them is that because there is no intellectual content, that you can see that ultimately all of the masks of evil are very frightening, but evil itself in the final analysis is impotent against Dante. Nonetheless, okay, he observes who the greatest traitors are and then moves on. And I suppose it's up to us also to say something about the three final traitors, because, of course, they are the three, the winners of the who are the greatest sinners of all time contest in 1300, turn out to be Judas and turn out to be Brutus and Cassius. Probably easier to see what Judas is all about there. He betrays Christ. And again, with a kind of interesting cannibalistic image here, he is being eaten by Satan's central mouth. We see his feet sticking out. But the other two sinners in the other mouths, Brutus and Cassius, might not be quite so obvious to a contemporary reader, especially if it's a reader who comes to these folks through, let's say, reading Shakespeare's version of this story in Julius Caesar.
Well, for Dante, the Roman Republic was leading to empire, because Dante believed in the ideal of empire, in the ideal of world government, where there wouldn't be any competition for power, and therefore power would be used wisely, because there was nothing to be gained from using it poorly or badly. And so for Dante, Julius Caesar was the one to bring the empire into being in Rome. However, of course, Brutus and Cassius thwarted that effort. It took another round of civil wars and another generation before Augustus emerged as the emperor. And Dante believed that God would not send the world a savior until the world was at peace with one government. So that the murder of Julius Caesar not only caused a lot of lives and another round of civil war, but it also postponed God's plan. It messed up the plan as it was going. And so they were also working against heaven's design, just as Judas was. It's hard, as Ron said, for us who know this was the noblest Roman of them all stuff, to understand that Dante's operating in a very different political worldview than Plutarch, the source for Shakespeare's Julius Caesar.
Last thing I guess we have to do in Inferno is get out of it. And it's not as easy as it sounds, because, of course, you're at the very bottom. But remember that Satan himself is encased in ice. Fortunately, there's a little hole there, and Dante and Virgil sort of slip by the hole and are kind of going along the legs of Satan, all of a sudden realize that instead of going down, they're going up. Okay, so his last view really is to see the legs of Satan. They're sort of a kind of pathway all the way up, and it ends with Dante and Virgil, as it says, "We climbed, he first and I behind, until through a small round opening ahead of us, I saw the lovely things the heavens hold, and we came out once more to see the stars." Well, in the next lectures, we will take a look at things where the stars are visible and where light is visible, and we'll move to purgatory.